I'm John Kroll. This Saturday is the Indiana Authors Awards Dinner and Festival, a day-long celebration of the literary arts in Indiana. Today on No Limits, we will talk about the event and about the state of literature here in Indiana. My guests are Regional Authors Award winner poet Adrian Matika and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation and Eugene and Marilyn Glick, Indiana Authors Award Coordinator. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indiana Authors Awards. The dinner is this Saturday night, and the all-day Indy Author Fair is this Saturday as well. This is a celebration of the literary arts in Indiana, and we're going to be talking about it today, talking about the state of literature and hearing some great poetry today on the show. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are the regional Indiana Author Award, Regional Author Award winner, who is a poet, Adrian Matika, and returning for, we have established now, her fourth visit to the show. One more and she gets the Saturday Night Live red velvet jacket, I guess. It's Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. She's also the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award Coordinator. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have both of you here. Well, Laura, let's start by talking a little bit about what the Indiana Authors Awards are. And I probably ought to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, that I have a long relationship with the Indiana Authors Awards. I was a panelist, one of the judges, for 3 years, and every year I moderate the discussion among the finalists and winners for the library. So in the interest of putting everything out there, there is a relationship there. Laura.
That's right, John. This is the 7th annual Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. It's just a way to celebrate Hoosier writers, aspiring writers, established writers. So we have a couple different events. We have a daytime full of free public programs at Central Library from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. this Saturday. We've got workshops on blogging and poetry and writing fiction and humor and just kind of everything that aspiring writers would want to know. We also have conversations with our winners and finalists. Along with Adrian, we have Marianne Baruch, the national author winner, and then three emerging author finalists, Laura Bates, Skyla Brown, and Clifford Garstang. We're also honoring Indianapolis poet Mari Evans with a Lifetime Achievement Award. This Saturday, so we'll have a program of Mari's friends and professional colleagues honoring her long history here in the Indianapolis community. So again, it's all free and open to the public this Saturday at Central Library.
Where can people go to find the schedule of events?
Our website, indianaauthorsaward.org. It has the full list of programs there.
Okay. And there is the dinner on Saturday night. Is it sold out?
It is sold out, yeah. I think
so. People have to start earlier.
That's
next
right.
Year,
this
right?
is, I think, the fourth straight sellout. So we've got a ticketed award dinner to, again, celebrate those authors that evening.
Adrian, I want to start by saying I really enjoyed your most recent book of poetry, The Big Smoke. If I'd still been on the panel, I would have voted for you, too. So,
thank you, John.
Certainly. I'd like to talk, and I don't think I'm ruining the reading experience for anyone by saying it is a particularly imaginative retelling of the famous boxer Jack Johnson's story, sort of from his perspective and in his voice in poetry. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything quite like that. Could you talk a little bit about how you arrived at the conception to do it that way?
Yeah, sure. And John, thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor to be on WFYI. I know I'm supposed to be talking about the poems, but I have to say this. Uh-huh. The first time I felt like an adult was when I was listening to WFYI when I was in college.
Oh, wow.
So it was like the moment where I felt like I was engaging with the world. I was listening to Terry Gross, but, you know, it was still.
I listened to Terry Gross, too. The
sentiment is the same, right?
Yeah.
But the Big Smoke, well, I would love to talk just a little bit about the tradition that the book comes mm-hmm. out of. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great history now of books of poetry that interrogate history through the imaginary of the poet. I think Rita Dove, who was poet laureate mm-hmm. for a while, kind of kicked it off mm-hmm. when she wrote Thomas and Beulah about her parents. Mm-hmm. But then there's Marilyn Nelson, who wrote a book about George Washington Carver. Mm-hmm. There's Tyon Bajess. He wrote a book about called Lead Belly, about the blues musician Lead Belly. And so there have been, you know, I mean, there are many more, mm-hmm. but there have been a series of books of poems where the writer reconsidered history through poems. And so I think I was trying to write into that tradition with this book to begin with, but there was nothing about Jack Johnson mm-hmm. in it. I mean, there were no... Kevin Young wrote a book called To Repel Ghosts about mm-hmm. Basquiat, mm-hmm. and Jack Johnson shows up in that. But the man himself, his mythology, his history had not been explored in poetry.
We probably ought to talk a little bit about who Jack Johnson was. Sure. There are going to be people who may not be familiar with the story.
Sure, sure. He's such a fascinating figure. I mean, Jack Johnson was the first African-American heavyweight champion. He won the championship in 1908 by beating a guy named Tommy Burns. Jack Johnson's parents were slaves. So they were born before emancipation. They both lived on plantations. So Jack Johnson was the very first generation after slavery. He's coming into a world in America that wasn't quite sure that it believed that African Americans were actually human. It's a stunning thing to even say out loud, but you know, we were so backward and so unaware at the time. So here's Jack Johnson, this very complex and imaginative human being. He's spending the whole part of his energy just trying to convince people he's actually a human. So the dynamics of the time that he was existing in are staggering mm-hmm. in that way. So he's the first heavyweight champion, 1908. He had to quit school in third grade to work to make money. He taught himself how to play classical music. He taught himself how to read. He used to recite Shakespeare. He was a very complex and wonderful figure. And the same, and he was also a groundbreaking boxer. I mean, he was really the first modern boxer who considered how to defense instead of just offense.
And he was an intensely controversial figure at that time. I mean, there was a concerted effort, in part because we are talking about a still very segregated America. I mean, yeah. this is a good 45 years before Brown versus the Board of Education.
Sure,
And all of that, that there was a concerted effort after he won the title to try to strip it away from him.
Absolutely. Maybe to put it in a little bit of historical context, even he won the heavyweight championship 12 years after Plessy versus Ferguson. I mean, mm-hmm. this is really early, as mm-hmm. you said. And so not only was there a concern that this African-American was the heavyweight champion and became what was essentially the most famous athlete in the world. I mean, everybody knew who Jack Johnson was. And they didn't like him, but they knew who he was. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, as famous as the president mm-hmm. in some ways. And, so not only was he this man who held this great position that had always been a position that a white man had held, but he also was married to a white woman. He had these white mistresses he ran around with. He had cars when nobody had cars. So he had all of these things, he was a 21st century athlete at the turn of the last century. And so if you can imagine a country that is so vitriolic about race, mm-hmm. to have the most famous athlete of that country be of this race that they despise so much, it was complicated.
I think now that we've given people a little bit of a taste, I do want to talk more about Jack Johnson and all of that. But I'd like to ask you to read one of the poems from the book, if possible. Could you set it up and then?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I think a good way to get into his biography and into this book is the first poem, mm-hmm. right? And it's called Battle Royale. And for those who are familiar with that term or are not familiar with the term, it's a kind of fight that they used to put on as entertainment, where they would put five or six African-American men in a ring and have them fight until one was left standing. Ralph Ellison's brilliant book, The Invisible Man, has a chapter where the protagonist has fights in a battle royale. So this is called Battle Royale. Back then, they chain a bear in the middle of the bear garden and let the dogs loose. Iron chains around a bear's neck don't slow him too much. A bear will always make short work of a dog. Shakespeare said Sackerson did it more than 20 times to dogs and wildcats alike, and since most creatures are naturally afraid of bears, there wouldn't always be much of a show in the bear garden. So the handler sometimes put the bear's eyes out or took his teeth to make the fight more sporting. I believe you need eyes more than you need teeth in a fight, but losing either makes a bear a little less mean. Once baiting was against the law, some smart somebody figured colors would fight just as hard if hungry enough. So they rounded up the skinniest of us, had us stripped to trousers, then blindfolded us before the fight. They turned us in hard circles a few times on the ring steps like a motor car engine before pushing us between the ropes. When the bell rang, it seemed like I got hit from eight directions. I didn't know where those punches came from, but I swung so hard my shoulder hadn't been right since, because the man said only the last darky on his feet gets a meal.
That was Battle Royale from The Big Smoke, which is Adrian Matika's fascinating and beautiful book of poems about the experience of African-American boxer Jack Johnson. I ask, and I'm leading the conversation here, sure. Because I think one of the things that is fascinating about this approach to telling a life story is you really do have to imaginatively disappear into somebody else's experience, be able to speak at least imaginatively in his or her voice. How did you first come to Jack Johnson? I mean, what made him a fascinating figure for you? Let's talk about what pulled you toward him in the first place.
Sure. So my mother is who introduced me to Jack Johnson. My mother was a huge boxing fan, and in the 70s we used to watch, you know, all the great heavyweights, George Foreman and Muhammad Ali, of course, and Ken Norton, and you know, she would we'd watch these fighters, and she would always bring up Jack Johnson. I'm going to tell the sort of sanitized version of it, because there was gambling involved and things like that around the base. But she would bring him up, and that's how I learned about Jack Johnson, was through my mother.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards. We're talking with Regional Author Award winner, the poet Adrian Matika, and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Adrian, in terms of being drawn to him, and I understand he's a fascinating figure. I mean, in some ways, the only modern parallel I can think of would be Muhammad Ali, but there were even extra dimensions to Jack Johnson's story that weren't there with Ali's. How did you go about doing your research? Because as you say, there's an awful lot of mythology attached to the man, too, that you have to penetrate.
Yeah, so Jack Johnson, one of the best things about him was he was a self-made man. Right. He was the kind of not only did he teach himself the things that he knew and got those experiences on his own, but he also created his own myths. He would tell these stories about himself that people took as fact, because it was possible. It was Jack Johnson, you know. So he would, for example, tell it the story about how he got in a fight with a shark when he was 12 years old. Right. And he would tell the story over and over again. And after a while, people believed it. Sure, it's Jack Johnson. Of course he could beat up a shark. And so in order to get to him and through those things, I did a lot of research. I spent 8 years working on this book to begin with. And I researched for 2 years before I even wrote a poem. So I read biographies and autobiographies and newspaper reports and interviews. I had something like 22 primary sources for the book at one point. And then they just spun out even more. And so I spent a great deal of time trying to learn about the time he lived in to try to write about it.
What was the thing that most surprised you?
How modern he was, really. I thought I was getting into a conversation about a boxer, and I realized that this man was just ahead of his time.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards, which are this Saturday, the Indiana Author Fair, which is also Saturday. We are talking with Regional Author Award winner, the poet Adrian Matika, and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards. The big awards dinner will be this Saturday night. Unfortunately, as one of my guests, Laura Wills, has already informed us, all of the tickets have been sold, so you'll have to aim for next year's dinner. But the Indiana Author Fair, Indy Author Fair, is going on all day Saturday with events from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are talking with Laura Wills, who is with the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation and is the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award Coordinator, and also the regional award winner, poet Adrian Matika, who has written a fascinating book of poems about the early 20th century boxer Jack Johnson called The Big Smoke. I'm going to pursue the conversation more about Jack Johnson because I think everybody can tell that I'm fascinated by the story. but I would like to have Laura talk a little bit more about the awards themselves, what the criteria are, and what the process is that led to Adrian becoming an award winner.
Sure. So it's a statewide process. We begin in February when nominations open up. The criteria is you have to be born in Indiana or live here for a period of 5 years. So on our website, IndianaAuthorsAward.org, next February, you can look for the nominations. We take nominations from the public. People can nominate themselves. Publishers can nominate their authors. So once we have the nominations, we have a statewide award panel, 8 to 10 people from across the state who come in and go over all the nominations, spend hundreds of hours reading these books, and kind of come down to the final decision for a national author winner, a regional author winner, and 3 emerging author finalists. And this year's kind of the year of the poet. In addition to Adrian, we have our national author winner, Miriam Baruch, and one of our emerging author finalists, Skyla Brown, is also a poet. So that's kind of something new for us. We've honored poets in the past, but never 3 in 1 year. So that's exciting this year.
How many nominations were there overall?
We usually get about 150 nominations for 100 different authors, approximately. And we also, nominations stand for a period of 5 years. So we can go back through the last 5 years and consider authors who've been nominated in the past as well.
This is a question we got after the last time we did this show. Someone sent it in. If you have won the award once, are you eligible again afterwards or not?
You are. The only time you wouldn't is if you win the National Author Winner, the National Author Award. But a regional author winner could then be known on a national level, or an emerging author winner could move up to the regional or national category. So,
how do you make the distinction? Because Adrian here was a National Book Award finalist. So obviously he's got a national profile.
Sure. The criteria is kind of loose. We let our award panel make that distinction. But basically a national author winner is someone whose work is read across the country and is well-known nationally, regional. Their work is well-known across the state and maybe just hasn't been at it as long as a national author winner in some cases. But we let our award panel kind of put people into categories.
And the emerging are people who have just recently published.
Correct. No more than 2 books published within the past 10 years.
And again, the events start Saturday at 10 a.m., and they can go to the library's website to find out what's going on?
Yes, or IndianaAuthorsAward.org. All events are free and open to the public during the day.
And again, if you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards, which are this Saturday. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So the question here that really fascinates me now, Adrian, is how did you get inside Jack Johnson's head? I mean, how do you, you know, because you have to write with his voice, or at least what you imagine to be his voice. I understand the distinction there. Yeah. How did you go about doing that?
It started with the research. As we talked about earlier, I spent a great deal of time studying not only the places and various geographies he lived and the ways he lived his life, but also his own language as best as I could find it. I mean, he has two autobiographies, three actually. But two of them were ghostwritten by a French guy and translated into English. So I'm not sure that that's actually his language, right? There were all of these biographies that quoted him, but they quoted the newspapers. And so sometimes those newspaper quotes would be accurate. Sometimes they would be kind of minstrelized through the media. You know, I mean, these sports writers didn't like Jack Johnson any more than you know, most all the sports writers were white guys just about, and they weren't particular fans of his. And so sometimes they would render him in a way that was true to his voice or seemingly true, and other times they would make him sound like he was illiterate, which was not the case. So when I was trying to find a voice for him, I tried to use what I thought was kind of the center of all of these various examples of his voice. I'm not sure I'm being clear about this, but I imagine them to be very far apart, and somewhere in the middle was what his voice actually was. So it wasn't, he wasn't a minstrel, and he also didn't sound like an English professor. You know, it was somewhere in between those that I imagined him to reside. And so I spent a lot of time trying to craft a voice that I thought was sophisticated like he was, and authentic like he was. And so, and a big part of it was getting out of the way of the language, you know, moving myself, my 21st century aesthetic of language out of the way of his early 20th century aesthetic, if that makes sense. So basically, the less I was involved, the more authentic the voice felt.
And I'd like to give people a little another taste of what that voice is like. If you could first set up another poem and then read it, please.
Sure. I originally thought I was going to read. He had gold teeth, which is fascinating to me. And I thought I would read a poem about his teeth, but as we were talking about his voice, I think maybe I'll read a poem that is. Made up of quotes, almost the entire poem is as full of quotes, and it's called Sporting Life. So at this time, a person that would live, who hung around with boxers, who hung around with gamblers, and sort of people with that lifestyle was called a sport. And so they called the lifestyle itself the sporting life. Sporting life. People are always talking about if and suppose, like those words are worth more than money, more than the crease a silk socking makes on a woman's thigh, more than the grumble of a Thomas Flyer engine. So I take the sides of my pleasures, two small words, if and suppose, and nobody can explain them. We get in this world what we're gonna get. After all, one man can roll out of bed and be killed while another man falls from a scaffold and lives. A man can get a bullet in the brain and keep his life while some other poor sap dies from a shot in the leg. It's all luck and perspective. Pleasure is both to me.
That was The Sporting Life.
Yeah.
It's a poem from The Big Smoke, and an imaginative retelling of the experience of the early 20th century African-American boxer, Jack Johnson's, read by Adrian Matika, who is the poet who wrote The Big Smoke. I got to add, because we were talking the break about Jack Johnson's life choices. I'm trying to choose as neutral a term as I can here to describe them, because this is, as we pointed out, a very segregated, a very racist America at that time. He became champion in 1908. That act all by itself was considered offensive to huge portions of the white population in the United States. And on top of that, as you pointed out, he was married to a white woman. He had white mistresses. I sort of asked during the break, I never can tell whether, you know, in what I know of his story, whether it was courage or rage that was fueling him. Mm-hmm. You obviously know his story a lot better than I do. What was your conclusion?
Well, I don't think that it was either, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was an incredibly brave person, and I know he was angry mm-hmm. about some of the things, but he was an American in that early 20th century way of doing big things and making something out of yourself. I mean, Galveston was much less segregated as a port mm-hmm. than most of America was. So he grew up with a different expectation. I mean, you know, he was aware that there were things that white America would be unhappy about, but he was less concerned with them. He was going to get his. He was going to make his money. He was going to become a star. He was going to do those things, and I think that was his motivation more than anything else.
What drove the need for the attention? I mean, you know, most people who defy convention in that fashion and, you know, aspire to do what he did, which is to get to the top of a profession, to be recognized as the best at whatever you do, there has to be some sort of compulsion that is pushing them forward. Where did his come from?
You know, I think he always wanted to be a star. He always wanted to be someone who was outsized and bigger than everyone else. One of the dangers of biography is that we go back and we impress meaning on things, childhood mm-hmm. actions. You know, well, when he was in second grade, he won the spelling bee, and that showed us all he was going to be the next James Baldwin or mm-hmm. whatever. You know, there's these kind of things that don't actually equate, mm-hmm. and we look for them. And you know, sometimes I think it's just simple. Some people are just meant to do big things, and that's who he was. And racism wasn't going to slow him down. Coming up in such modest circumstances was not going to slow him down. If anything, it drove him to want more. Yeah.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about specifically the Indiana Authors Awards, which are this Saturday, but more generally about the state of writing and poetry in Indiana, and particularly a fascinating book of poems by one of my guests, Adrian Matikas, called The Big Smoke, which is about African-American boxer Jack Johnson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Shannon has done and send us an email. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Shannon says, "I have loved libraries since I was a small child, but I'm over 50 years old. I know libraries have had to adapt to the times, but can your guests talk about how they feel libraries remain relevant to those of us who miss the card catalog days?" Laura, I think that one goes to you.
Sure. Well, I think that we all love libraries. I think that's why one of the reasons that we're here. But I think that libraries are community centers, first and foremost. And here in Indianapolis, our libraries are undergoing a change with a lot of input from the public of what should that space look like. And the books will always be there. Shannon will be pleased to know that print books still take up the majority of the budget for purchasing materials. But now we have e-books, and we have a place where people can access the internet or use their computers or meet with people in their community. And so libraries have to be really nimble and reflect what their community wants. And I think we're so lucky here in Indianapolis to have the library system that we do that really does reflect what our community needs. And along those lines, I should mention one of my favorite parts about the award is that each of our winners gets to choose an Indiana public library to receive a $2,500 grant. So it could be the library where they grew up or the library that they use now. But it's been really interesting over the past, this will be the seventh year, to see how those different libraries across Indiana use that grant money. And I think it, again, goes back to what their community needs.
Adrian, which library is getting your grant?
Pike Library, Pike Township Library, where we were just there last week giving a presentation, and it was incredible to see how different it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the best ways, it had expanded quite a bit. And I'm of the tradition that Shannon is, where mm-hmm. I miss the card catalog sometimes. And going back to Pike, where I I was there for the grand opening of that library when I was in high school. I used to go there after school with my English teacher looking for books that were outside of our curriculum at Pike High School. And it meant so much to me. I can't imagine that I would be where I am now teaching English and trying to write books had I not spent so much time at the library.
How did, when you decide you want to write or you want to express yourself, there are all sorts of ways you can pursue that passion. What drove you toward poetry? And I'm not saying that in a challenging way at all. I'm just curious.
Being a poet is a strange vocation. You know what I mean? It's the kind of thing that you don't bring up on the airplane in polite conversation. But we're taking over the Indiana Authors Awards this year.
You are. Poetry represent.
Now, well, you know, I came to poetry.
A very gentle, hostile takeover.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's got lots of rhyming words. I came to poetry through music. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even want to be a writer. I wanted to be a rapper. I was just really, really bad at rapping. And so I had the distinction of hearing Yusef Komunyakaa, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and used to teach at Indiana University back in the 90s. I heard him read, and it was the closest thing to music I'd ever heard. I mean, it was like hearing a song when he would read his poems. And I gave up all my aspirations to be the next, Notorious B.I.G. and decided to write poems.
How do you know, and this is a question I always ask writers, how do you know when it's good or when it's right, when it begins to feel, because there's a lot of missteps along the way when you're trying to write. And I would think that's especially true because the form is so precise.
You know, for me, I think it's a very loving relationship that I have with poems, and I love them when I first write them, and with this great blinding love. And the longer they're around, the more complicated our relationship gets. The first night or the first morning I write a poem, I think it must be the most amazing thing that I've ever done. But by the next day, I realize that it's problematic. And so, for me, it's a very long, arduous process to write a poem.
When you say that first night, it's a long and arduous. How many drafts, for example, did the poems in The Big Smoke go through?
Oh, probably 14, 15, 16 drafts. I mean, major revisions, maybe two or three. But then I'm changing a word here and a word there, reorganizing lines. If it's in a form, I'm fighting with the form. There are a lot of sonnets in The Big Smoke. And so I'm trying to work in that space. It is precision. It takes an incredible amount of attention to detail and music to write a sonnet. Mm-hmm.
Laura, was there any deliberate intention to make poets sort of the focus of this year's Indiana Authors Awards? Did it just emerge organically?
It just emerged organically. We look at each category, and our panel chooses who they feel is the best author in that category. And when we were done with the intense deliberation, we kind of looked and said, "Oh, we've got three panelists or three poets, and then four if you include Mari Evans, our lifetime achievement." But to me, it's exciting because I think for a lot of us readers, we don't experience when we think about poetry, we think about what we experienced in high school or maybe college, and this Adrian's book was not like any poetry that I read growing up. So to me, it was really exciting. And I've been telling a lot of people about it who I think might not necessarily be quote unquote traditional poetry fans, but they like rap songs or they can appreciate trying something new. And so I think that's what's exciting about the Indiana Authors Award is getting to experience something that you might not before.
Adrian, is that part of the motivation also? And you talked about the forces that kind of led you to writing The Big Smoke. Is it also a way to engage with a new audience? Because poetry has had to struggle to find an audience.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of it has to do with the way that we get introduced to us early on. I mean, if Shakespeare is the only kind of poetry you've ever read, and you've never read Mari Evans, for example, who is part of the Black Arts tradition, where I imagine I'm situated somewhere as a grandchild of that, it's hard it might be hard to see how diverse and how wonderful poetry is now.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indiana Authors Awards, which are this Saturday. The Indy Author Fair runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, and the dinner is that evening. We are talking with one of the winners, poet Adrian Matika and Laura Wills of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the Indiana Author Awards, which are this Saturday. The Indy Author Fair runs from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Central Library in Indianapolis. My guests are the poet Adrian Matika, who is this year's Indiana Regional Authors Award winner, and Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. She's also the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award Coordinator. Wanted to talk real quickly about the events themselves. I mean, we've said there are a lot of things that people can do on Saturday. What are some of those?
The doors open at 10 a.m. at Central Library, and the first event is a program celebrating Mari Evans, our Lifetime Achievement Award winner. So it starts at 10:15 in Clues Auditorium in Central Library. So we're having a jazz duo and people reading poems inspired by Mari, written by Mari, just a celebration of her life and work. Then immediately following that, we have a slam poetry workshop for children and teens. We've got a blogging session, writing nonfiction books, how to get started. If you've always thought you might want to write a book, but you're not quite sure what to do, we're in partnership with Indiana Writer Center. So we've got lots of their experts teaching these workshops. So we have a workshop on humor. And then there's also the Meet the Authors panel with Adrian and our other winners and finalists, where they'll get to hear about their writing life and kind of how they get started, just an informal panel discussion. And then they can also buy books and have them signed by our authors, too.
Yeah, one of the best parts of that is I think you have all kinds of Indiana authors gathered at the library who are there to sell and sign their books. If there's a book that you particularly love, you can show up and get it signed and actually talk with the writer.
That's right. We've got more than
himself.
Yeah, we've got more than 40 up-and-coming Indiana writers at Central that will be there to talk to the public.
And again, I probably should disclose that I have a relationship. I was one of the panelists and judges in years past, and every year I do the Meet the Authors panel at the library. Adrian, you know, in terms of the big smoke, I think probably at this point, I'd like to ask you to read one more poem, and then I want to sort of walk through the rest of Jack Johnson's story.
Sure.
And then talk about what else you're working on in connection with it.
Yeah, no, that's great. I thought I'd read the last poem in the book, which, again, I think when you're working in biography, it doesn't spoil the ending, because it's not the ending of his story. It's just the ending of this book. And it's called Il Trovatore, after Verdi's opera, which was Jack Johnson's favorite piece of music. And if I could tell a really quick story about that. So Jack Johnson loved this opera so much that he would have several copies of it on hand. And this is, you know, 1912. It's not like you can go to the record store and buy records. He would order these in bulk. He also had a valet who he would have carry a gramophone around with him to play Il Trovatore while he was
training. Not a shy man.
No. So this guy would. So this valet, who I should also say was white, because Jack Johnson thought it was funny to have this guy carry him around. His name was Gaston. Okay. Gaston would carry this enormous gramophone around, cranking it and playing Il Trovatore while he trained, and it was like the first boombox or something. Il Trovatore. The first time I heard the aria, it was like sunup after the great storm, the woman's voice rising, then rising more, as if the want of it all wouldn't allow her another breath. Like road work when you've punched yourself out, like Tommy Burns catching my gut hook, like the first I saw of Etta, like the sound of the crowd in Reno when Jeffries couldn't go on, like going up the steps of the cafe to Champion after a crash of gunshots in Etta's rooms, like finding Etta on the floor, a halo of blood getting bigger by the minute, like the nurses, not nursing, but crying and pointing at the gun still hot in Etta's own hands, like realizing Etta still breathing, whispering a libretto on the heels of her last breath. You did this, Papa. You did all of this.
That was the poet Adrian Matejka reading from The Big Smoke, the last poem in the Big Smoke, his imaginative retelling of the experience of the early 20th century African-American boxer Jack Johnson. We were talking before the show about how for many Americans, particularly many Americans of my generation, their initial exposure to the Jack Johnson story was the play that at least originally featured James Earl Jones and then was made into a movie called The Great White Hope,
yeah.
Which was, in some ways a tour de force, obviously, for James Earl Jones. It established what a powerful presence he was on stage and on screen. But as history, as you pointed out, was somewhat faulty. But that's another one of those of sort of those smoke screens or whatever that you have to work your way through to tell the story, because that is the popular perception of what the story was.
Yeah, that's and I've been brawling with that version of Jack Johnson's history for quite a while now because of that. It was so deeply immersed in American culture that Jack Johnson was James Earl Jones at the Great White Hope. And I think his name was Jack Jefferson or something.
Yeah,
in that.
Yeah. It wasn't fooling too many people.
Yeah, exactly. Well. I mean, it was very, very thinly veiled.
Yeah.
But there's something, really fascinating to me about that anyway, as frustrating as that version of the story is, having done the work. I'm not really sure that Howard Sackler did. I don't know. But if he did, he just ignored what he found. And mm-hmm. so it's a sensationalized version of mm-hmm. Jack Johnson, but he still won the Pulitzer Prize. So it seems to me that there's something quintessential in Jack Johnson's story that even a limited version of it mm-hmm. can garner that much interest, if that makes sense.
In what ways did it deviate from the real story, other than Jack Jefferson for Jack Johnson?
Well, yeah. the depiction of Jack Johnson himself. I mean, for those who've seen the movie or seen the play, he's like this country bumpkin that's kind of, he's not nearly as sophisticated as he actually was. And, he's basically, the story is this guy who has a thing for white women, and that's the story. The story is not about pulling oneself up, for example. Mm-hmm. Or, it's not about eventually becoming, a model for what was possible for other people. It's none of those. It's a very simple up and down story. He becomes heavyweight champion, and then he's not anymore. And so, there are a lot of problems, just place and time, of course, in Sackler's version. But just fundamentally, the version, the presentation of Jack Johnson mm-hmm. is just not who he was. It's mm-hmm. just, very basic. It's not him.
Well, and in some ways, the title said it all. The fact that it was The Great White Hope,
yeah.
It was really more about white America's response to Jack Johnson than it was about Johnson himself.
Yeah, and so this is, we're having, it's a very important kind of, there are two conversations. There's the inaccuracy of Sackler's Great White Hope play and screenplay. And then there was the brilliance of James Earl Jones and Jane Alexander
who do just explode.
Yeah, they were extraordinary to the point where I was like, I wish this was better, because you two are really elevating this. But if you actually, when you see Jack Johnson, there are videos of him. There are recordings of him speaking, and he sounds, he's an incredibly erudite person. He doesn't sound like he's from the backwoods. It's none of that. He is a cultured sort of a figure.
If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can tumble on us on Twitter @WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Mary has done and reach out to us via Facebook @NoLimitsWFYI. Mary asks, are playwrights allowed to submit into the Authors Awards? Thank you. Laura?
Yes, they are. We consider all written work. So, yes, they can submit their nominations next year when they open up in February for the 2016 Indian Authors Award.
And again, exposing the fact that I was part of the process at one point, I know there was a prolonged debate about whether self-published work should be included or not. Is it included? Is it now something that can be submitted?
Yes, self-published authors are now eligible. When the award began in 2009, self-publishing was a lot different than it is now. So we had to kind of...
Stephen King wasn't doing it back
then. Exactly. Yeah. So we've adjusted as time has gone on. And yes, self-published authors are eligible as well.
Are there any categories of published work that are not eligible for the Authors Awards?
We don't take things like textbooks and that kind of thing. But all of the criteria are on our website, indianaauthorsaward.org, so people can visit and then just send us an email if they have any questions.
Okay. Well, I want to take us into, Adrian, and I appreciate your patience with me here because I really have been fascinated by Jack Johnson's story. And I loved your book. I thought that took me into what is a seminal American story in a way that I had not visited it before. So in terms of where you're going now with Jack Johnson's story, The Big Smoke, the book of poems, was really just the first part, right? You said you're working on something else connected with it right now.
Yeah. Well, so when I started researching Jack Johnson, it became clear that I couldn't write a book big enough to tell the whole story, the part of his story that I wanted to tell. I couldn't fit it into a book. It needed to be two books. Mm-hmm. But I also knew I didn't want to write two books of poems. So I thought I would write The Big Smoke and then maybe work on a book of essays, mm-hmm. Or something like that. And I'm a comic book geek. Mm-hmm. I used to ride my bike to the comic book store in Broad Ripple when I was a kid and spend my allowance there. And it's something I've always wanted to do.
Carnival, remember it well.
It used to be one of those things where I'd get my backpack, I'd go down there, and that was how, that's how I got my comics. And, somewhere along the line it occurred to me that there's no rule against somebody who writes poetry writing a comic book. There's nothing that says I can't try to do that. And I was lucky enough to get a group of people that were supportive of that idea. And so I'm writing the second part of this story, and it's a graphic novel. And it picks up after this book ends and goes through his conviction of the Mann Act and going to prison and getting out. And it's definitely a different version of him. But that's just a separate thing. I finished my new book of poems, too, and that's going to be out in 2017, and it's all about Indianapolis. It's all about living here, and I would have never written it if I hadn't come back to Indiana.
What does it have a title?
Yeah, it's called Collectible Blacks.
Collectible Blacks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did that title come from?
Oh, there's a great Sun Ra. You know, the jazz musician Sun Ra has a great album called Antique Blacks, mm-hmm. and Sun Ra is the thread in the book. And I thought, I would love to play on this title, Antique Blacks, somehow, and so. Where I came up with Collectible Blacks.
What does winning this award mean for you?
Oh, it's such a great honor, and thank you again, Laura, for your support. I mean, I think that it's always, we're talking about poetry, first of all, it's always fortunate when anyone listens to it or reads it, and we're so lucky when people are willing to take their time out to do that. So when you get an acknowledgement of any kind, I think it's a little bit overwhelming, but to get something like this, which is directly tied to where I'm from and who I imagine myself to be, the Indiana Authors Award, that's a really big deal to me. It means just that much more because it's coming from people who are invested in the same places that I'm invested in. If I mention Georgetown Road or if I mention Comic Carnival, they might know those places. Mm-hmm. That's something totally different than some other kind of attention that you might be able to get.
How important is place to you as a writer?
It used to not be important to me at all. As soon as I graduated from Indiana, I was out of here. I finished my degree and I moved to Chicago and then I moved to Seattle and then I lived in Eugene and I lived in upstate New York. I lived in like 10 different places. And at some point I realized I was going in a big circle and moving closer and closer back home. And so it used to, or at least I believed it did not matter But the moment I recognized that I am only who I am because I grew up in Indianapolis, and I am only who I am because I went to Indiana University and did these things, it became incredibly valuable to me, and I wanted my daughter to have that too. I wanted her to be around her grandparents and around my sister and brother and the people that I grew up with. I wanted her to have at least the contemporary version of what I had as a child here.
Writing, whatever the medium, is about really about a process of attempting to discover truth. Yeah. Are there some truths about home that you have to discover by leaving it?
I think that we tend to romanticize places that we don't live in. You know, it's easy to be down on the place that you see every day, but once you get away from it and really look at it and look at how sophisticated and incredible Indianapolis is, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to look at it any other way.
Again, the springboard for this is that you have won the regional Authors Award and the Indiana Authors Awards, which is a day-long, I keep calling it festival, literary arts on Saturday that begins at 10 a.m. and will go until 5 p.m. And actually, it goes on beyond that. It's just you need a ticket to attend the stuff that goes on afterwards. After we bought a ticket to the dinner, which is sold out. How big a crowd, Laura, do you expect?
We usually have between 500 and 600 people who come to Central Library for the various events. I mean, if you are a writer, an aspiring writer, if you're a book lover, there's something at Central Library for you on Saturday. So please come, and you'll hear more from Adrian and our other winners and finalists and other Indiana authors. It's going to be a really fun day.
What part of it are you looking forward to the most?
I love spending time with authors, and I'm happy that I've gotten to know Adrian, and a lot of our former winners are coming back too, and I've been able to stay in touch with them and just learn so much more about the talent, the sheer talent that we have here in Indiana. It's wonderful.
Adrian, what part are you looking forward to the most? I mean, what part, you know, what part excites you the most about being part of this?
The fact that I'm a part of it at all is really exciting. But I'm just thrilled that Mari Evans is getting this award. I mean, she's just incredible and such an important writer, and it's great to see that kind of recognition for her.
Well, that will be Saturday starting at 10 a.m., and it will go in through the parts that are, and I should emphasize again that they are free, right?
Everything is free
and open to the public. From 10 a.m. until 5 p.m., you'll get to meet the authors, you'll get to get books signed, take part in workshops and all sorts of other events at the Central Library in downtown Indianapolis. Well, I would like to thank my guests, Laura Wills, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, and Regional Author Award winner, the poet Adrian Matika. I've enjoyed talking with both of you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Thanks very much. And I'd like to invite our listeners to come back on Thursday when we are going to be talking about ways that we can energize the political process. That's not a small discussion. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.